baby. I'll give it to you.
That looks really good.
Yes, it does. It's dead on.
Okay, keep the chatter down in this room.
Are you ready to begin?
Yes, I'm all set, bro.
Welcome to Space Boffins. We're in partnership with the Naked Scientists. I'm Richard Hollingham.
And I'm Sue Nelson. This time we have two space shuttle astronauts in conversation as Anna Fisher talks to Nicole Stott about spacesuits, shuttle flights and women in space.
And I'll be chatting to author David Brown about his new book, The Mission, charting the story of NASA's Europa Clipper mission to Jupiter's icy and watery moon.
Plus, we're joined by a fellow podcaster and space enthusiast and historian, host of the Space and Things podcast and founder of the 20,000 strong Facebook community, Space Hipsters. It is Emily Carney. Welcome, Emily, to Space Boffins.
Thank you so much. I'm honored to be a part of this. Thank you very much.
Oh, no, well, we're delighted
you
to have you.
Now.
Yes, yeah. You might not say this. This might ruin your reputation. And you're based in Florida, aren't you, Emily?
Yeah, I live in St. Petersburg, Florida, not too far from where all the launches and stuff happen.
And not too far from Nicole Stott, actually, as well. So that's pretty cool. So how did Space Hipsters start for those? I can't imagine there might be some of our listeners may not have heard of Space Hipsters, but they will definitely know by the end of this. So how did it start?
Around 2010, I started a blog called This Space Available, and it's now available in the National Space Society blog roll. I'd always been a space enthusiast, but I really was just starting to really super get back into it again. And around February 2011, it was sort of like the space shuttle program was sort of coming to an end around that point. And I was like, man, you know, I want to start a Facebook group about space, but I don't know what to call it. And my husband was like, well, just call it Space Hipsters because you think you did everything first. You know, he was just joking. And the group started and originally we had about four people, but it really did take off. Within about a year, we had about 100 people. So at the time I was like, wow, 100 people, that's all we're going to ever have. In the last decade, I mean, I've been sort of shocked. It's really taken off. Now we have, God, I don't even know how many people. How many people are in the group?
I think it's over 20,000, isn't it?
You said 20,000.
I said 20,000. Yeah, yeah. So I must say, but you know, it could have gone up since I last looked at it. What I like about it, because I'm very happy to be a part of that group, is that you can never be too nerdy. In fact, if anything, I feel positively underqualified to sometimes take part in conversations.
No, I do too. Like, there are people in the group. I mean, we have a few, actual people flown to space in the group. We have, you know, a lot of technicians. We have a lot of workers. We have a lot of authors. If I ever have a question about something, somebody in there knows it, you know, so that's pretty incredible to me, you know.
And is there anything that, you know, from this last sort of 10 years then, are there certain subjects that just touch everybody's buttons that you almost have to say, look, hold on there, partners, let's not get into this again?
Oh, God. A big topic of, I guess, contention where people loved getting fights about it is SpaceX versus SLS. That's a big one because, you know, they always want to be like, oh, SLS is never going to launch and, you know, all this stuff. And to my knowledge, Artemis 1 is supposed to launch at year's end. So I think they're probably incorrect. We don't like that kind of rivalry within the group. You know, we're Team Space. We just want every launch provider to succeed, whether it's NASA or SpaceX or ULA or Rocket Lab or whoever. You know, we really like to see them all succeed because we want, you know, the idea is we want everybody to go to space. We want space to be accessible. And, you know, what better way to have it be accessible than to have, and Blue Origin, I don't want to leave them out. What better way to have space accessible than to have, you know, a lot of different launch providers?
And Sierra Nevada Corporation, I think you have to add, don't you?
Absolutely, yeah. I don't want to upset anybody by leaving them out.
Is that an issue, though? Because I think it's an issue that we have as science journalists. Essentially, we're fans. You know, we want this stuff to happen. Like, sports commentators are sports fans. It is quite difficult to remain objective and to remain impartial and not say, wow, look at what SpaceX are doing. Aren't they great?
As a journalist, you know, it is kind of hard to remain impartial because I think what SpaceX is doing is amazing, but, you know, we try to keep it in perspective of, okay, we're not going to allow people to, I'm trying to find a delicate way to put it. We're not going to allow people to diss, you know, one launch provider over another, like say, oh, these people are better than, you know, another person and stuff like that. We don't really want that sort of a negative kind of rivalry. I think we would like to be supportive of everybody.
But that's the delicate balance though, isn't it? Because at the same time that, you know, we all love things space, also we're critical as well. We're not going to agree with everything that they do. I mean, I find it extraordinary the way SpaceX are so tight-fisted when it comes to giving out interviews, for instance.
Exactly. Yeah.
That infuriates me. That really drives me nuts.
Yeah, I do agree. It can be, you know, frustrating. You know, as a journalist, I'm not really used to that. I'm used to writing somebody and they write you back and say, yeah, we can talk, you know, about this. So I do get that.
Yeah, well, stay with us, Emily. We will talk more in a moment, especially about your podcast too.
Thank you.
Now, I recently made a radio program for BBC World Service called The Equal Right Stuff, telling the story of NASA's 1977 intake of astronaut recruits. They included the first women, the first African Americans, and the first Asian Americans. It was presented by shuttle and space station astronaut Nicole Stott and featured one of those first women and the first mother in space, Anna Fisher. Anna was working as a medical doctor in an emergency department when she applied to be an astronaut. In 1984, she would end up flying one of the most ambitious of the shuttle missions, capturing two faulty satellites from orbit and returning them to Earth. Well, we could only use a little bit of that interview for the programme, but we thought you'd like to hear more of it. So here's a conversation between two astronauts, Nicole Stott and Anna Fisher.
My first job was to work in the area of spacesuits. And of course, they didn't even have a shuttle suit. So I was using Pete Conrad's A7LB, which he was the shortest of the Apollo astronauts, but still his suit didn't fit me. And as you know, probably better than I, that when you have a suit that doesn't fit well with all these air pockets in them, you know, you're not only is the work hard, but you're fighting the buoyancy of the suit. So I would have to say that of all the things I've ever tried to do, that was, you know, really the hardest physically and mentally. You know, as you know, getting into the water tank with this whole team of people and all they're there for is to support you and watch you. And again, we didn't have the same preparation that crew members get now, where they give you all these runs and they teach you different techniques. We were just kind of figuring it out for ourselves. But again, you know, despite how difficult it was still very rewarding. And it was sad because the way the shuttle suit is designed originally, it was to accommodate the full range from 5th percentile female to 95th percentile male. But it just turned out that when you got that hard upper torso small enough to where it really fit someone my size, or your size for that matter, getting into it was just so difficult. And so finally, after a period of time, and of course, with all the budget overruns and everything, the decision was made just not to spend that extra money. You had to fit in the medium or the large.
When you look at it from that standpoint, you know, most of the women in the office are on the smaller side. And to see the success, I mean, I am really, well, I'm proud that I was able to do it too. But, you know, to watch, you know, women working in these suits that really are not, you know, are not designed to fit them at that, you know, in that point. And it's incredible to see that. It's an unnecessary disadvantage, right? In all of it. And I would have to say that in all of my astronaut training, that was the one place I felt like there was this challenge that didn't need to be there, you know? And I'm happy that as we're moving forward with, you know, the future of suits, that's something that is a priority to be accommodated as well.
Oh, yes. I'm certain that you can design suits that'll fit the full range of people in the office. But, you know, again, it always comes with a price tag as well. And I understand the realities of all those things. And so from my perspective, although personally disappointed, you know, I'm a team player in that sense. I never wanted to be in a position where I would be trying to do a task that I couldn't do well because I wasn't in a suit that fit me well enough. But, you know, that leaves a lot of work for the future. And just seeing all these women doing all these amazing things makes me incredibly proud.
So, again, stepping back just a little bit, back to your first spaceflight assignment. And when you were assigned, you were pregnant. The media seemed to be obsessed with that, you know, and that you were a mother. God bless you too, just in general with being in the astronaut office that, you know, with that going on. You know, cause even in 2009, when I flew the first time and I wasn't pregnant when I was assigned, there was a focus on the question of being a mother and an astronaut. And I understand the interest in it. I really do. But I always wondered why our father crewmates never got the same question. And I imagine you had to deal with that as well.
Again, I'm so grateful we didn't have the internet and Twitter and all that stuff. Thank God. Because, you know, recently there's that picture that John Bryson took of me with the helmet and stuff. And somehow it wound up getting into the internet, and people were talking about me being a mother and all that stuff, commenting, and they were talking as though it, you know, was right now. Like, is it okay for her to go into space because she's with a mother? I'm going, hello, guys. That was like 20 years ago.
Yeah.
But again, you know, you're just in your own little world at that point. I was very fortunate to have a absolutely wonderful lady who came in and took care of Kristen during the day, and for shuttle training. You know, for the most part, until the very end, your training was like from 8 to, you know, 4 to 6, depending on what kind of day you had. So I'd get home and I'd have the whole evening with Kristen. And in fact, and we took lots of videos because we didn't know, you know, for sure what was going to happen. And we joked that's the reason Kristen wound up going into broadcast journalism, was because we took so much video that first year in case anything happened, so she would at least remember me.
I think that leads nicely into my next question, which is, you know, I think we all understand what the ultimate risk of spaceflight is, and it's certainly a consideration for all astronauts, and, you know, especially when you're thinking about how you prepare, you know, yourself and your family for what's coming with the flight. I understand that before you flew, that you also wrote a letter to Kristen. And I'm not expecting you to go into any details, but was this something that you guys figured out on your own to do? You just felt right, or did somebody else encourage you?
Actually, the story behind that is interesting because, you know, we went into quarantine and our families left before us, and then we were going to the house to pick up any things we needed after they had left. And as I was leaving quarantine, Dave Walker, who I know you know, and many people would not consider him the most sensitive of people, he looked at me and he said, well, are you going to write the letter? And I go, what do you mean the letter? And he looked at me and he goes, you know, the letter. And I'll have to say that I don't know if I would have thought of that on my own. Maybe I would have, but it really surprised me that this pilot who had fought in Vietnam, many combat missions in Vietnam, went to test pilot school. And I guess maybe I'd always understood the risk, but I think that really hit me that he, someone that many people might not think of as the most sensitive person, said that. So I went home and I wrote a letter to Kristen and I wrote a letter to Bill, and I put them in my jewelry box and told Bill they were there, and luckily they weren't needed. But that was the story behind that.
Well, and it's carried on. I mean, I get goosebumps thinking about it, and I think mine are still in storage somewhere. But I mean, I want to talk a little bit about your flight too. You know, you were on a mission. Your mission, you know, there were a lot of firsts about it for sure. But like rescuing satellites, as you know, as someone who years later had the opportunity to capture HTV-1, I know what that weight felt like on my shoulders. I cannot speak for you, but you were the robotic arm operator for that. And just like the EVA stuff, I have to imagine that the preparation I got for HTV was significantly different than what you were presented, you know, working and figuring out how to capture that free fly and spin and satellite in space. I mean, how did that feel for you? I know we talked about it before I did HTV, but I got to hear it from you again.
First of all, if I could have picked a flight to be on, that's the flight I would have picked, and my crewmates, you know, it was just an incredible flight. But I'll backtrack a little bit because in February of 84, which was the flight that deployed the two satellites, and also it was the first flight of the manned maneuvering unit with Bruce McCandless. So I was sent up to New York to be on the Today Show to provide commentary, not for the satellites, but for, you know, for Bruce's free flight with the manned maneuvering unit. So as I leave Houston, they had problems with the first satellite, that the rocket that was supposed to take it from low Earth orbit to geosynchronous orbit failed. And so I head up to New York and I'm thinking, well, there's no way they're going to launch the second one. And of course, that's again before the time of iPhones and everything. So I get into the taxi to go to my hotel and I'm talking with the taxi driver and we get talking. He says, no, I think they just deployed the second one. And I think it had the same problem. And I said, no, you must have misunderstood, you know. So I get back to the hotel and I call, and sure enough, the taxi driver was right, Mark, the ways we communicated back in those days. So anyway, I get on the Today Show. And so now they're asking me questions about, you know, why this happened and that decision. And, you know, I'm thinking, it's a polite way to say it. Beats me why they did that. But so anyway, they asked me, well, do you think NASA will go get these satellites? And I said, absolutely no way. These satellites were not designed to be retrieved. You know, the arm needs to have a special grapple fixture to get it and, you know, all this sort of, you know, so I gave all the rationale, which, man, those are the best words I ever ate in my life. So yeah, it was just really fun. And, you know, it was so much fun because we weren't just being trained. We were part of the development of the hardware, the procedures, and all of that. And no one had ever done that. So it really was exciting. But the thing I remember most, and I'm sure you probably felt the same way, everybody had their responsibilities, and this was yours. And the mission, you know, relied on whether you were successful or not. And as I went to go in to grab the satellite, all I can remember was all the simulator didn't reproduce all the motion. You know, here's the satellite over here spinning. Rick is maneuvering the shuttle a little bit to stay in station keeping. The Earth is rotating. The clouds are moving. All I remember was so much motion. And here you are just focusing on trying to go in and grab the satellite and just, you know, ignore all that. So that's the thing I remember most about that. And man, I was really glad when that was over successfully.
It is. Is this like that? It is. It's like this. It really is like a weight. And I don't know about you, but I have to imagine there was something similar. Is, you know, we got HTV captured, and then, you know, you can push, the button gets pushed and you're in a safe configuration, right? And then I remember, I mean, there was so much focus in that with, you know, and the crew behind me and, you know, Bob and, Frank there, you know, by my side as I was flying this thing, and the button gets pushed, we're safe. And we looked at each other, and all of us, there was like this little kind of tremor in our hands. And I'm like, it was like this release, this, you know, the adrenaline had done its job for good. And now you could chill a little bit. You could let your body respond to this load that you'd felt. And I don't know, it felt strange, but it felt really good at the same time.
Well, you know, the other thing that was interesting about this flight compared to later space station rendezvous was we had to do the rendezvous. But while Rick and I did the rendezvous, because Joe and Dale and Dave were below getting them suited, because as soon as we got up to the satellite, we had to start a 6-hour EVA, spacewalk. So you really didn't get much of a chance to just relax. And one of the things that I felt particularly grateful for was because Dave and Joe and Dale were below getting suited up, it was just Rick and me doing the rendezvous. So that was really, really fun, just because in general, the mission specialist doesn't get to do that. But then as we're, you know, because of, again, being only a 5-person crew, Rick had to be the backup arm operator because Dave is busy being IVA, helping our crew members outside, and then Joe and Dale are outside. And if you go back and look at our first rendezvous and all that, there's almost no pictures at all. Nobody had time to even think about photographs. So after in the day in between, we really talked it over and said, hey, we're going to have to be a lot more conscious and figure out, you know, how to get photos for the second one. So, but anyway, that's that I found that to be very interesting as compared to watching the later flights that went to space station, because it was just, you know, 16 hours of pure adrenaline, pretty yeah. much.
NASA astronaut and trailblazer Anna Fisher talking to astronaut Nicole Stott.
And trailblazer Nicole Stott, Stott, yes. We could have
better say that.
Have both of them there. Emily, what did you think about hearing them talk about their spacesuits? Because that really sort of chimed with me in terms of making you realize how uncomfortable it has been for the women who've done spacewalks, not having a suit effectively designed for their bodies.
Wow. I do have a lot to say. I don't want it. Like I said, this is a family friendly show. So in private, I would probably cuss a lot about this kind of stuff. I'm sort of reminded about when a couple of years ago when there was supposed to be the first female spacewalk. I think initially it was supposed to be Christina Cook and Anne McLean, I think initially. And I think they had to wave it off because in space, obviously, your physiology changes. And I think Anne McLean could not really fit into her spacesuit. So they had to sort of wave it off. And I remember at the time, and obviously McLean couldn't help that, you know, because in space you do sort of grow, I guess, to put it mildly, because your spine changes. At the time, I remember sort of being incandescent with anger about it, because I was like, nobody in NASA saw this happening or could foresee this happening, you know, because I really wanted an all-female spacewalk to happen. And it did happen eventually, because later, I think Jessica Meir and Christina Cook did the spacewalk together eventually. So it did happen, but we had to wait a while. But the shuttle spacesuits were designed over 40 years ago. You know, I remember seeing people like John Young and Bob Crippen putting them on in like the parabolic flights, you know, testing them out. So they were probably mostly tested on males. So didn't probably leave a lot of flexibility for, you know, women who we might be the same size, you know, height wise as men, but we don't have the same dimensions. We just don't.
What I think is interesting about that whole group of astronauts, and not just the women there, it was the first time we got a different type of astronaut. They're still superhuman. They're still exceptional yeah. people, but they're more normal. They're more, listen to Anna Fisher. She's not one of the, I mean, you mentioned Bob Crippen and John Young, those sort of, you know, right stuff types of the 1960s. These were a very different breed of astronaut for the most part.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. They're definitely more relatable to me. As a kid, you know, growing up in the South, in the, you know, the 1980s, you know, I remember reading the Jane Spaceflight Directory and from the library, because I was kind of precocious. I remember reading that, you know, and thinking, you know, at the time, I didn't really have an awareness that women had been to space or there were women astronauts. You know, I was very much used to the, you know, archetypical, you know, male right stuff astronauts from, you know, the early shuttle era, because that's what I had seen in the news really so far. And then when I read, you know, Jane's and I started, you know, sort of watching more TV and stuff, I became aware of, you know, women like Judy Resnick. I'm Jewish, so seeing her go to space and seeing, you know, and she was such a personality too. I mean, she had that amazing bouffant of hair and she went to space and she just, those pictures of her, you know, with her hair up and out. I mean, those should have been on the front page of every newspaper because it was just, it looks so different from what I was used to seeing in books. Because I was used to seeing, you know, the fighter pilots and the, you know, the guys from the 60s like John Glenn and John Young, who are fine people, but they just, you know, they had a certain, they look very standardized, you know, whereas somebody like Judy Resnick just looked like literally like just represented a completely different world.
I wonder whether the fact that, I mean, she was also, she was vivacious. She was glamorous as well. And it's sort of the whole package, isn't it? It was as like you say, as far away from some man with a crew cut who's maybe quite tight-lipped and disciplined because they've got the military background. And yet she was incredibly like all of them. They were all so bright.
Yeah, she was incredibly well qualified to do that job. I mean, she was a pilot, a very capable pilot. She was, you know, obviously an incredible scientist, very brilliant. The thing as a kid that got me was just, it sounds so superficial, but it's just, I thought the hair was so cool. She was wearing the sunglasses. She just did make it look really glamorous. And I, you know, when I saw that, I was like, you can have a career in spaceflight and you can still be, you know, yourself. You can still be, you know, if you want to be glamorous, you can be glamorous. If you want to, you can have sort of a personality and do what you really want to do. So for me, seeing that, that was a huge moment as a kid.
What interests me is that you have had a career in the military yourself, in the Navy as an engineer. So what attracted you towards, you know, what particularly over the last sort of 20, 30 years? I mean, it's changing now, but for a long period of time was considered that a bit like the old astronauts, a very sort of male dominated area.
That's a really great question. And you're absolutely right. When I first joined, it was in the mid 90s. I was a nuclear mechanical operator on an aircraft carrier, and I had to go to school for several years before I even went to the aircraft carrier to learn that job. There were a lot of parallels to that sort of, you know, the transition between the, you know, the right stuff era and, you know, when they started hiring women in the, you know, in the late 70s, because when I first joined, I was one of the first women on my ship. I was probably among the first five who showed up. They had just started integrating women on the ship I was on at the time. I was on the USS George Washington. I was so young, I didn't really have an awareness at the time. But now looking back, I mean, there were people who looked at me like I was an alien from another planet. I mean, it was just wild because they just hadn't seen, you know, somebody who just even looked like me, because I was, you know, most mechanics are these big, you know, muscular guys. And, you know, there I was, I'm very short in real life. You know, I'm not very muscle bound. You know, I look sort of like a regular person. And it was kind of a culture shock, I'm sure, for them and for me as well, because, you know, I had people who literally were like, oh, let me do this for you, or you can't do this, so I'm going to do it for you. And I'm like, wait a minute, you know, wait a second, I can do this just fine, you know. So it was kind of, I think there were probably a few parallels. I mean, I think the first women who became astronauts, when I've heard them speak, they've been very, they've made it pretty clear that for the most part, they felt, you know, pretty welcomed in the astronaut corps, except, you know, maybe for a few things.
It's really interesting because, you know, talking to the women for this program, it was absolutely, they all said NASA did its very best and everyone around them did their very best to integrate, to make it normal, a new normal, having women in the astronaut program. The issue seems to have been the media, actually, and the perception and how they thought Americans would take to women in the program.
I agree. I've watched a few media clips from the time, especially with Sally Ride and Judy Resnick, because they were the first two. And I remember watching a press conference, and Sally Ride was getting questions, you know, such as if something, you know, I may be misquoting here, but like, you know, if something goes wrong, do you think you'll start crying? You know,
no, you're pretty much spot on with the actual quote. Yeah, it's
stuff
extraordinary.
Like that. And she just started laughing because, of course not. You know, she's a professional. She would, you know, she's not going to just break down and lose it, you know. And I think I watched a old clip with Judy Resnick being interviewed by Tom Brokaw, who's, you know, this very, very archetypical male reporter from the 1980s who was on NBC, I think. And he was asking her questions, you know, like, what do you say when a guy, you know, meets you and he says, hey, cute little lady, you know, and what do you say to that?
It's like the 1960s.
It's pure Ron Burgundy.
It is Ron Burgundy.
It was like Ron Burgundy. And Judy was really actually pretty awesome about it. She basically just like, you know, I just tell him I'm an engineer. And I was like, that's a great answer to it. And she was really, I would have probably wanted to punch him in the face or something, but she was very, you know, I think she was awesome at, you know, dealing with that kind of stuff. Whereas, I probably would have reacted more like Sally. I would have just started laughing.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's lovely the way it's so different now. I mean, they announced relatively recently that Samantha Christopher Retty was returning to space for the European Space Agency and that she's going to be commander on the space station. And Samantha has also been part of the sort of new recruitment drive for ESA, where they've specifically said, you know, women, we want you effectively. If you've got any form of disability, don't think you're going to be disqualified. We want you, you know, they're really sort of thinking much more diversely in terms of their crew. And I love the way as part of the sort of, you know, improving that diversity, Samantha had done just a short video saying, you know, I've got two children. If you want to apply to be an astronaut, you can. You can be like me. You can be a parent. You can just don't rule yourself out. Has there been a similar sort of excitement and reaction and also sort of more commonplace acceptance in the States that, yeah, we're going to get a woman on the moon?
Honestly, I think in the United States, it's not viewed as a big deal. I think people are so used to the idea of having women in space now that it's not really viewed as like, you know, oh my God, they're going to put a woman on the moon. I think it's more viewed as we're going to put people back on the moon.
Do you have any insight into who might be that woman?
Oh my gosh. Well, I've seen the Artemis poster, and I do have to say, I think every woman on that list, I mean, is just more than qualified to step on the moon. Oh my gosh. That's really tough to say because I don't want to leave anybody out. If I could have them all step on the moon, I think Kayla Barron, I think she's one of the Artemis astronauts. And she's going to the ISS soon, later this year. But she's also a woman who worked in nuclear engineering in the Navy. And if I saw her step on the moon first, I think I would just about collapse.
Explode.
Yeah. I think I would just about die because I'm like, wow, they put one of me on the moon. Like, that would really, like, you know, but
that's yeah. A for all mankind parallel universe for you, isn't it? That one.
Yes, absolutely. Completely. I think I would just about faint. So.
Well, stay with us.
A couple of bits of admin. Do check us out on social media. You can find pictures of the solar eclipse line in Richmond in North Yorkshire from July 1927. But I was reading about it.
That's because we were there for
in North Yorkshire,
break.
Northern England. Yeah. Big publicity in lead up to it. There were special trains laid on. There were special hotel deals, all the rest of it, all the stuff that you still have today associated with eclipses. It was really disappointing. Hardly anyone got to see anything.
This sounds very familiar. This sounds like the last UK eclipse as well. It's just, we've got terrible weather for it.
And Bjorn from Sweden has been in touch, but not that one.
Oh, okay.
With some more music. And we'll hear that music later on. At the end of the podcast. It's really nice. It's really good. This is Space Boffins. We're in partnership with the Naked Scientists.
Do get in touch on Facebook or Twitter. You can also email us at podcast@spaceboffins.com or info@boffinmedia.co.uk.
If you're new to Space Boffins, do follow the podcast. Maybe you could write a review. But not before you've listened to our next item. In 2024, NASA plans to launch a mission to Jupiter's moons to investigate Europa.
Europa is the most likely place to find life in our solar system today because we think there's a liquid water ocean beneath its surface. Now we know that on Earth, everywhere that there's water, we find life. So could Europa have the ingredients?
That's
Bob Pappalardo featured in a NASA video about the Europa Clipper mission, which will study the moon from Jupiter's orbit. Bob is also one of the heroes of a new book called The Mission, and the author is David Brown. David, thanks for joining us on Space Boffins.
Thank you very much for having me today.
Now, before we get onto the book, let's talk about Europa. Is it our best hope of finding life in the solar system?
Without question. When you really look at the numbers, Europa is more likely to be habitable than the planet Earth. For those who are not aware, Europa is the ocean moon of Jupiter. It's about the size of our moon, but there's three times more liquid salt water on Europa than there is on Earth. And by water, I don't mean some weird scientist's definition of water, some green alien goo, but actual, the same stuff that we see in our oceans. You could take a cup, plunge it in that water, and drink it. It wouldn't be healthy for you, and I don't advise it, but your body would know what to do with it. And because of that water, because of the chemistry that water creates when it touches the seafloor, that rocky seafloor, and because of heating from inside of Europa itself, you basically have all the ingredients you need for life. It is by far the most habitable place in the solar system, and it's quite extraordinary that we would find life on a place so unlike Earth, and yet it would be life as we know it.
Now, that water is trapped under these, well, they look like rafts of ice. We don't know there's life there, but we do know there's water there. So that's the assumption, is that that's the best hope, really.
Exactly. So to get life, you're going to need organics, you're going to need water, and you're going to need chemical energy. We know this in large measure because that's what's necessary for life on this world. The composition of Europa is fairly well constrained. So we know that the organics are there. We know that the water is there. It is beneath an ice shell. And that ice shell is actually quite protective of life in that ocean below, because Europa is in a highly radioactive part of space. And the chemical energy can come in multiple ways. You can either have hydrothermal vents on the bottom of Europa, which is most likely what is the case. And we see that on our seafloor as well. These sort of hot columns of water billowing out from the inside of the Earth. And life down there absolutely loves it. It's just teeming with life down there.
If there is such a good chance of there being life there, why has it taken so long for us to have a mission to go there? And I should talk about your book, really, because it's great. But it's written in a narrative non-fiction style. You've written it as a thriller. And because the journey to get there, the journey to get to this Europa Clipper, which won't even land, it goes back decades.
Europa is a very, very difficult place to explore. It exists in what's called the Jovian radiation belt. The conditions there are like the immediate aftermath of a detonated thermonuclear bomb. And that's a consequence of Jupiter's massive magnetic field and sort of the interplay of particles in space. The simple version is Europa orbits in just the place that's least hospitable for robotic spacecraft. And that's how we would have to explore a place like this. There have been enormous engineering challenges along the way. How do you explore such a thing? How do you constrain the habitability of a world like this? How do you do it in a way that's affordable? People tend to think that NASA has this massive percentage of the American federal budget, but that's not the case at all. NASA gets 0.5% of the budget. It's practically a rounding error compared to something like the Defense Department. And consequently, these sorts of missions that launch every 10 to 20 years, these are called NASA's flagship missions. They're constantly seeing small cuts at the margins in order to accommodate diminishing NASA budgets. So it's the only reason this sort of mission ever launches in the first place, and not just this one, but there are several, but this one in particular has had a difficult time. The only reason these sorts of missions launch is because of dedicated scientists who, I mean, frankly, they're, you know, these aren't like billionaires who are living the dream life. They work very hard, and it's pretty thankless work. And you could spend your entire career to try to get a mission going, and it never actually get approved, or it get approved, but by the time the mission is built, launches, and returns data, I mean, you're retired, if not dead.
It's so depressing. You give the impression that NASA is obsessed with Mars? Is that just because it's easier? I mean, is there an element of we can do this, we can land something on Mars, but the risks associated with getting something to Europa, it's just not worth the effort?
There's a lot of that. So NASA is first and foremost a human spaceflight organization. The S in NASA does not stand for science, as some people like to say, which means Mars has a sort of a natural leg up on the competition simply because astronauts are going to walk there one day. And so if you want to propose a science mission, you're really, from NASA's point of view, you're getting twice the return. You're getting science back, and that's great. We're going to understand Mars, and we'll understand more about the origin, you know, the history of the solar system and so on. But the real benefit there is whenever we send an atmospheric probe to our orbiter to Mars, or we send a lander and we better constrain the things necessary to land large, heavy objects on Mars, we roll around on the surface and we collect soil samples or whatever. What you're doing in addition to getting really cool science is you're buying down risk for a future astronaut mission. You're answering a lot of those unknown unknowns or known unknowns in order to make things safer when astronauts get there eventually. So NASA has always had before NASA was even founded, the people who would become the initial leaders of NASA, they were far more interested in going to Mars than they were going to the moon. The Apollo program was sort of an anomaly. It was a stop along the way, but it was never meant to be the destination. So to that end, human spaceflight makes it a natural target. The other thing working for it, of course, as you said, is Mars is closer. I mean, you can launch a spacecraft there every 2 years, and it's only about a 9-month journey. And that has enormous benefits. If you're NASA, you have very little money. You've got to do the best you can with what you've got. Mars is the sure thing. Mars is the safe bet. Europa, that's quite a daring mission that they're going to, that they're building right now, and that's going to launch in 2024. And that mission is Europa Clipper. So it would be nice. I mean, it would be the most important question in the history of science, religion, or philosophy to know if there was a second genesis somewhere else in the solar system. But, from a practical standpoint, NASA is going to go to Mars if given the choice.
Now, as I said, you tell this story as a thriller. You get really inside people's heads. You are saying what people are feeling. And I suppose the parallel is with Tom Wolfe's The Right Stuff. It's the first to do this with the space program, really. How did you do that? And how was that received when you show the book to the people you feature in this? Because you are telling their thoughts, and these are people who are still around.
That's right. So the book took 7 years to write, and when I first started writing it, the Europa Clipper mission had not yet been approved. So these people's life's work had not actually been given a green light. So they took an awful big risk talking to me in the first place, because I could have derailed decades of work if I had published something that I guess wasn't respectful of the story that they had lived. In that time, over 100 people were interviewed for the book, hundreds of hours of interviews. It was exhausting for everyone involved. But over time, I think they came to see that I was actually doing my homework. I was actually someone worth talking to. I mean, so you mentioned Bob Pappalardo. He's the head of the Europa Clipper mission. He's the project scientist on that spacecraft. When you talk to the world's foremost subject matter expert on Europa, the first question you ask him is not, so does Europa have an ocean? Like, you've got to actually do your homework so that when you go to these people, you get questions answered that only they can answer. So initially, I think early on, they sort of could tell that I was serious about this. And eventually they came to see the sort of book that I was writing, and there were some weird questions along the way, which is how I get some of the, I guess, the humorous anecdotes in the story and sort of really inside their head. I will say that after I finished writing the book, I had to send, a couple of them copies of the manuscript, not because I needed their approval, but because I needed to make sure that I just didn't totally screw this thing up. Because there was a good chance, and I was terrified that they were going to be a little bit surprised by the sort of the eccentric nature of the narrative voice in the book, because a lot of people expect a very traditional work of nonfiction, kind of the staid sort of prim and proper scientist type book. And this is not that. This is a bit more rollicking. And in every case, They were enthralled. They were thrilled by the product. It was funny. So when I sent Bob the book, because there's a lot of science in the book, it's not a science book, and the reader doesn't have to bring any science to the table. You don't have to know anything to read this book. The book will do all the heavy lifting for you, but there is a lot of science in there, just by virtue of the subject matter. And when I sent it to Bob, I was terrified that I would have to rewrite 100 pages or something. And I was very gratified to see he wanted one word changed in the entire book. So that considered that a great success.
No, that's absolutely brilliant. To win the trust, which is obviously key. Great use of the word rollicking there, I thought. Very good. What about Europa Clipper? I mean, it's still an amazing mission. It's going to be an incredible mission to get there, to be able to study Europa. I mean, what everyone really wants is a lander. I mean, is that doable? Is that feasible?
Absolutely. So Europa Lander, NASA spent over $100 million, or maybe $200 million, just studying how to do the lander. So development on it is pretty far along. The reason Europa Clipper is important before you get Europa Lander is because Europa, although the spacecraft Galileo spent a lot of time at the Jupiter system and did get some good images of Europa and collected a lot of composition and things like that, we still don't know what the surface of Europa looks like. And by that, I mean, if you look at like a picture of the Earth from the Apollo program or just from a space, satellite in orbit right now, you see a picture of the Earth and you recognize the continents. There's Europe, there's North America, there's Africa and so on. And it's green and there's blue. So there's foliage here and there's water here. But then I said, oh, now I need you to land something in Central Park in New York City. Like you wouldn't even know where New York is. You wouldn't know what Central Park looks like. You wouldn't know if there was a lake there. You wouldn't know if there was a mountain there. You would have no idea. And Europa's the same way. We've got these beautiful images from afar, but up close and personal at the scales, at the super fine resolution you need to actually say, I want to land right here, because this spot, based on our analyses, tell us, this is the place that will answer, this is the place that will answer the life question. We set a lander down here. It can saw into the ice and it can do its chemical analysis and we'll know sort of the answer once and for all. There's so many unknown unknowns in that case. There's so many variables that need to be sort of constrained given sort of left and right brackets. Once you do that, then you can send that lander and you can get the best answer because you've only got one shot at this, right? So a lander is going to cost about $4 billion. You're not going to get two $4 billion spacecraft on the surface of Europa. Not unless the first one lands and we see penguins walking around. Other than that, it's going to be, it's a one shot deal. So you've got to do it exactly right the first time. So Europa Clipper is less expensive than a lander would be. But it also gives you extraordinary science. So you're able to map that ice shell in three dimensions. You're able to constrain the size of the ocean, the composition of the ocean, things like the pH of the ocean. You're able to figure out, why does Europa work? So Europa was the first non-Earth world in the universe that we know has plate tectonics. It's slightly different than the plate tectonics on Earth, but it is plate tectonics all the same. And that sort of recycling of Europa's surface is one way that the ocean itself is oxidized. So you're able to answer all these fundamental questions about how icy worlds work, how these moons in the outer solar system work, how sort of the Jovian system came to be and how it operates. And you can extrapolate to different bodies in the solar system accordingly. So in its own right, it's great. But as a precursor to a lander, it's essential.
I love the idea there could be penguins there. It's not a completely frivolous thought, really, because, I mean, in Arthur C. Clarke's 2010 Odyssey 2, mm-hmm. humans are specifically warned off going to Europa. So, I mean, could there be complex life there?
I would say that if there's anywhere in the solar system that has complex life, it's Europa. So. What they're searching for desperately on Mars right now, by way of comparison, or what they're looking for in the clouds of Venus right now, is microbial life, single-celled organisms that might exist now but might have existed 3 billion years ago. We don't know. And that would be an extraordinary find. I mean, it would be a seismic shift in our understanding of biology. But life that you would find on Mars, life that you would find in Venus, very likely originated at Earth, or conversely, and this is getting sort of in the the outer edges of science. But it's interesting that there were some very prestigious papers or papers published in very prestigious publications in the last couple of years that hypothesize, you know, there's equally good chance that life originated on Mars and was eventually sort of cross-pollinated to Earth. And that happens, for example, when we look at the Chicxulub impactor, right? That's the asteroid that destroyed the dinosaurs. That impact was so profoundly powerful that one day when we have moon bases and we have archaeologists or paleontologists on the moon, they're going to be digging around on the moon and they're going to find dinosaur bones. And those dinosaur bones would have come from the planet Earth. So the same thing happens with life more generally. When you get these asteroid impacts on Earth or Mars or Venus or whatever, debris is kicked up into space and eventually the other bodies just sort of cross into it. Europa's not that. Europa's so far away from Earth that life there did not originate here. That means life there, as I mentioned earlier, had its own genesis. Life came from lifelessness of its own accord there. And yes, microbial life is possible, but complex life is equally possible. Unlike Earth, which has had multiple extinction level events. So the Earth is, you know, 4-point-something billion years old. We've had the surface of the Earth sterilized multiple times after life has taken hold. Europa's had 4 billion years of uninterrupted time to have life take hold and to evolve. It hasn't suffered the sort of extinction level events that we know of that the Earth has. So there could be some very complex life down there. And when you look at the animal life in our oceans, I think you'll find that things look pretty scary down there. Like you wouldn't recognize any of that stuff as even being of the Earth. So whatever would have taken hold and evolved on Europa would be extraordinary beyond imagination.
That's author David Brown. I do recommend the book. It is lovely, and it's written as a romping yarn, I would say. Romping yarn.
That sounds very British,
doesn't it? Yeah. It's really great. Emily Carney, host of Space and Things and founder of the 20,000 Strong Facebook community, Space Hipsters, is still with us. What do you make of missions to Europa? I mean, my feeling was about time.
Yeah, I really am excited about some of the new planetary missions, interplanetary missions that are coming out now. I've been sort of following, probably not in as much detail as other people, but I've been sort of following Europa Clipper for a long time, just because it's just Europa is just such an unknown quantity. There are so many planetary moons, interplanetary moons that are just, we just don't know anything about them really. And it's just, it's going to be so exciting to see a spacecraft sort of really investigate this totally alien world.
Do you think we've got a bit obsessed with Mars?
I don't want to upset my Mars friends, but I do think
you're the epitome of a space diplomat. You're doing very well. This is why you've got 20,000 followers. Yeah. That's great.
I do think we have become a little bit Mars obsessed, only because it's the closest planet. And it's really the planet that people have focused on, like, okay, we're going to try to go there and walk on it. For years, I've been like, why haven't we gone back and investigated Venus? You know, why haven't we gone back and looked at that? Because we've had very few missions to Venus. I think we had one Mariner back in the day, back in the 70s. Then we had Pioneer Venus. And then there was Magellan, and that was it, you know? And then we never went back.
The Soviet Union did pretty well on Venus. Yeah. They sort of targeted Venus, yeah. And getting a lander there was extraordinary.
I think I like the excitement online, actually, about NASA going to Venus, because I reckon it's probably going to be a little bit like with Pluto, is that we'll see the planet afresh.
It's really, I think, still such an unknown quantity because, like, yeah, we had Pioneer Venus in the 1980s, and it did some, you know, it had a radar altimeter. So it did some, you know, sort of surveillance of, okay, what's underneath the clouds. And Magellan did a better job with that. It really mapped the whole planet. But still, I mean, Magellan happened over 30 years ago. So really, I'm sure technology has come quite a long way since that point.
Absolutely. And congratulations, I think, are in offer. You started your podcast during the pandemic.
Yeah.
And it's great. I'm surprised you didn't start one sooner, though, to be honest.
I was honestly thinking of starting a podcast. I've actually been on a podcast called the Space 3D for a few years. So I've done some co-hosting on that podcast over the last few years. But I wanted to start, honestly, my own podcast for, God, the last few years, but I just, it was one of those things. I was either too busy or I just was like, man, I want a co-host, but I just can't, you know, I don't know if there's anybody I would vibe with as a co-host, you know. And
and how did you find it?
Let's not make any comments.
No, yes,
point.
Yeah. But, yeah, I was just stuck with him. And so how did you find this British singer-songwriter, Dave?
What happened was probably about a year ago, I'm thinking, wow, I can't believe it's been that long. Probably around a year ago, he reached out to me and he was like, you know, hey, I'm a, you know, you don't know me, but I'm in Space Hipsters, you know, I'm a singer-songwriter and I'm really interested in starting a space podcast, you know, would you be interested? And I thought about it and I was like, why not? You know, he seems like a nice kid. I'll be honest. I did not know him at all really back then. So it could have been disastrous. But he seemed, you know, really cool. And, we talked a few times, you know, online, we zoomed and we seemed to vibe really well together as, you know, just people.
It sounds like you've known each other a long time. So that's great. I think people are quite more shocked to find out that Rich and I are actually married, which I think.
no on-air chemistry at all. Just bickering. Yes. Yeah. Well, maybe that's the thing.
Yeah.
See, if I had a podcast with my husband, we'd probably just bicker the whole time. So probably just, that would be it.
And is the plan then to obviously, you know, keep going now? As soon as even post pandemic, you're just gonna, you know, keep doing what you're enjoying and loving.
Yeah. Oh, we're with the podcast. We're definitely keeping on. We've got a lot of great shows lined up in the next few months. I don't want to spoil too many of them. We got a lot of great interviews lined up, so we're definitely keeping on as long as we possibly can. So yeah, we're gonna still keep doing that. We're very happy that the space community has really sort of embraced us and we've gotten a little bit of a following since we've debuted. And, yeah, so we're definitely keeping on and, yeah, Dave and I get along really well. I'm very blessed. I have a really great co-host and we both are pretty much on the same page about a lot of stuff, which is pretty awesome. You don't always get that, you know? So,
about it.
Oh wow.
No, that's great. Well, I think we've always we always love the more podcasts on
more
space
podcasts, absolutely the better.
And yeah, it's just wonderful, and I hope it continues to be a success. And in fact, next month, July 2021 will be our 10th anniversary, which I can hardly believe. Yeah, we started July 2011. So yeah, we're trying to think of something special for that one. We're trying to top, what was it last month? Andy Weir.
Yeah. Well, we had Andy Weir, Jason, musician.
Oh, he was so funny.
And Helen Sharman.
And Helen Sharman, Britain's first astronaut. So, you know, I think maybe we peaked actually,
I think
Emily.
I think we peaked last week, last month.
I think we've blown it, but,
yeah.
Watch this.
Emily, thank you very much for joining us on Space Boffins.
Oh, absolutely. This was a lot of fun. Thank you so much. I'm really honored you guys invited me. Thank you.
You're welcome.
My documentary on NASA's 35 New Guys, The Equal Right Stuff, is still available on BBC Sounds. It will be available forever, as long as the BBC exists. You can hear more from Anna Fisher and Nicole Stott there. We're going to finish in a sec, as promised, with music from our listener Bjorn in Sweden. If you have anything space-related you want to share with us, do drop us a message or comment on the usual social media platforms. Our producer's been Jack Monahan, and we're going to hear the opening section of Nodes Part 1, The Sol System, from Oort Cloud Services. Bjorn says it's like a journey through the solar system in the form of a semi-atmospheric melodic ambient track with a speech synth giving a brief rundown of some of the most significant objects and checkpoints all the way from the sun to the Oort cloud.
First defining node for the measurement of our solar system. The following nodes are listed with their average orbital distance from the Sun. Mercury, 0.39 astronomical units. Venus, 0.72 astronomical units.